Bibi Gaston made this blog post in August last year in connection with her book Gifford Pinchot and the Old Timers that explores the beginnings of the U.S. Forest Service. They were called the Old Timers, she writes, and cat was not a part of their vocabulary. They were a domestic corps of 225 government men and women raised on responsibility, honed on humility, and committed to conservation. 40 years before the Greatest Generation, they were sent out to bring order to chaos, plant trees, tame the range wars, lay out paths, build bridges, fences, stone walls, and log cabins. They were hired to calculate distances, record stands, measure the depths of rivers, and mark timber for a growing nation. They thought of themselves as contributing to the greater good, and the man under whom they served, the man they referred to affectionately as their old chief, addressed them by their last names. Between 1905 and 1910, First Chief Forester Gifford Pinchot and President Theodore Roosevelt offered them a fighting chance at a better life, to go west and, quote, grow up with the country. Bibi Gaston continues, "When I first discovered 5,000 pages at the Library of Congress labeled simply The Old Timers, I didn't understand their significance. Over the past 10 years, I've come to think of these 225 letters as a kind of alphabet of American values containing ideas we could lean up against in times when solutions are hard to find and easy meditations fail. At first I laughed, then I wept, at last I hooted, and slowly came to believe that the old-timers collection would change us for the better. They would transform the national discussion. We'd start having a new conversation about who we are as Americans, which isn't an easy thing to define. The old-timers weren't trite or condescending in these letters. They were not talking in symbols or sound bites. They were talking about an America that belongs to all of us and for which they had decided to take responsibility. They talked about what they had done, how they did it, and what it had meant to the lives of others, how it was more important to serve each other than ourselves, how attitude was everything and courage was essential. I thought of the old-timers as showing us a way out of the woods, or a way back into the woods, to recall where we found our strength, our wealth, and what we cared about. I let their stories wash over me for years, each one resonating at a different time and for a different reason. Out of the blue, I'd recall some line or some idea that made sense all of a sudden. We might say the old-timers helped us make a course correction at a crucial time. They'd say they simply needed a job, or that they were lured by the call of the wild, by the scent of the noble fir and the sound of silence. One described the pasture grass where he worked as knee-high and country lovely. Gradually, I came to hear their stories as a call to a higher self. There is a story for each of us, but the old-timers are asking for something in return. They're asking us to put down our devices, pull up a chair, light a candle, and imagine. They want us to retrace our steps for the sake of America. They ask that we remember who we were 100 years ago when, one, Charles J. Baer of Pinedale, Wyoming, wrote to Gifford Pinchot, "It is all a beautiful country." Words of Bibi Gaston from a blog post in August 2018. Bibi Gaston is an award-winning landscape architect, author of The Loveliest Woman in America, and most recently, Gifford Pinchot and the Old Timers. Bibi Gaston is the great-grandniece of Gifford Pinchot, and she will be in Honesdale tomorrow afternoon for an author talk and book signing at the Cooperage, hosted by the Friends of the Wayne County Public Library. We had a chance to speak by phone with Bibi Gaston as she was en route from the West Coast to the East Coast, and we spoke about these powerful letters from the earliest days of the U.S. Forest Service.
The fantastic thing about the material is that it was buried in the Library of Congress along with about 2 million other documents. And this material is just 5,000 pages, but it represents, I found five blue boxes, five and a half blue boxes, at the Pinchot Collection in the Manuscript Division at the Library of Congress. And it was just an absolutely remarkable discovery for me because, you know, I sort of unfurled these pages and photographs and all of these things kind of fell out of the collection. And I had to put them into some kind of context. Who wrote these? Why were they a separate collection? And why was it that I'd never heard about these gentlemen? Or why were they not sort of at the top of some historical piece on the Forest Service? Because Gifford Pinchot actually wanted to write this book. He said that the history of the Forest Service should be taught and told by the men and women on the ground. And he died, sadly enough, before he was able to do that. So this material really was be his last work, his last book. And he wrote quite a number of books. I think there were something like 9 books that he wrote. But he didn't get around to it. So the material just sort of jumped out at me, in part because it was just so beautifully written. But also it sat as a subset of the much larger Pinchot collection, which is something like the third or fourth largest collection of personal documents at the Library of Congress.
What becomes so clear in the way you've assembled these materials is that this is a story for our time as well, not just about environmental concerns and conservation, but also about questions of leadership and what it means to be a citizen. It's all here.
It is here. It is in these documents. And, you know, I think it's spread out through Gifford Pinchot's personal collection, quite frankly, because he was a man that was completely dedicated to the country. You know, we can all split hairs and call each other socialists or whatever we want to say about each other posthumously, but it wouldn't be right in this case to deride this man who really, truly gave his life to the cause of natural resource conservation, without which I hate to think of what might have happened. So his dedication was thorough from really age about 16 or 17 to 80-something when he died, and there was a life just filled with insistence that we pay attention to the scope of work. This was not fuzzy planning. As Cornelia Pinchot, his wife, said, there was nothing fuzzy or sort of funky about conservation. It was exacting and dynamic. And he said that each generation needs to rediscover conservation in terms of their own problems and issues. So it's not as though conservation is just one thing. It changes and it shifts, and it's a dynamic practice. So I think the thing about the old-timers is that they do inspire us. And despite the fact that they are, you know, stories from the past, we might think of them as fuddy-duddy, they represent timeless qualities of both personal traits as well as leadership traits. And endurance. I mean, everybody uses the word resilience these days. But we have to say, well, what do I need to be resilient for? Because I think with so much confusion with fake news and all of this, whether news is fake or not, we aren't really sure what to focus on. So I think the thing is that we're in a period of just mass distraction and befuddlement. And these guys, when they wrote Pinchot, I think their emotions were pared down to the bare essentials because they were dealing just largely, well, with survival. And sometimes we get lost in words and in concepts and in fear. And these folks just had a way of cutting to the chase with Pinchot about, you know, the importance of their lives, their work, and what they had to give the country. And to hark back to what President Kennedy said, you know, none of these ideas are really new, but what is it that we can do for our country? And that's really what the old-timers focused on, because at the time there was perceived to be a wood famine in the United States, and Theodore Roosevelt understood the importance of natural resources like no other president. And so he corralled Pinchot and many others to involve themselves in this creation of the Forest Service. And the Forest Service really has safeguarded our natural resources from mass extraction, an extraction that would have been much worse had it not been for the creation of that agency. So the Forest Service has played an integral role in not only resource conservation, but in the concept of conservation nationwide. And we like to think, oh, well, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt that had created the WPA and the CCC, the Works Progress Administration, and the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was true. I mean, so much did happen under Franklin, but the reality is that so much of this started under Theodore. And Republican, Democratic doesn't really matter. The fact is that a group of citizens got together and decided this was important enough that we enroll these young men and women in an effort that was really quite extraordinary for the time and still remains extraordinary.
And you have used the word responsibility in addition to resilience of being in this together.
Yes, exactly. We do. We have a responsibility to sort of see something, say something, do something. And so what that something is, though, was fairly clearly defined by the old-timers. If it meant just surveying, taking notes, observing what was happening on the land, you know, 40% of our headwaters are now contaminated in the United States. There's been something like a 45% decline in songbirds. You know, our bird populations are in sort of in a terrible decline. Roosevelt would be absolutely just undone by this, particularly the bird, because, of course, he started the National Wildlife Refuge System and had a great passion for birds, as did some of the forest rangers that Pinchot hired. So, you know, the natural resources weren't an abstract concept. They were real. They were examined. They were understood. Water was water. What was water made up of? Trees weren't just trees. They were spruce, and they were hemlock, and they were birch. So much of what we can do as citizens right now is to observe things as they decline and what works. As a landscape architect, I'm particularly interested in that question.
In that world, you're sensitive to not only the topography, but you need to know about what will thrive in a place, not just the aesthetic things, of course, what would work well together and inspire us in terms of the way things grow on a particular piece of land. What was the relationship of these early foresters? Did they think in such terms about the overall ecology of what they were surveying or saving?
It's an ecosystem of thought as well as practice. And both Roosevelt and Pinchot were inspired by a third party, John Muir, whose name I'm sure you know. And he's a hero in the Sierra Club world. But he is also thought of as the modern, should we call him, the founder of the National Park System. The National Parks think of him as a kind of co-founder along with Roosevelt. But Pinchot was also a friend of Muir. So their thinking, there was a sort of a tripartite stool in a sense. Their thinking came together at a most auspicious time and, you know, formulated the backbone of not just the design for things, because, that, of course, Frederick Law Olmsted was involved in the design for Central Park in the 1860s. But Muir and Pinchot and Roosevelt come along quite a bit later and confirm a lot of Olmsted's thinking when it comes to the design. The design is integral with nature, and it works when it works, when it takes into account all of the not just the aesthetic, but the practical and the long-term planning aspect.
I was touched when I heard the story from Char Miller about the grave of Gifford Pinchot and the way he preferred that he be on the property in a place where the landscape was let to be natural, no finely mowed grounds with precision this, precision that, that he wanted in his final resting place to be part of the world of nature that meant so much to him.
Yeah, there's nothing fluffy about the Pinchot, or finely sort of pruned about the Pinchot image of finely tended lawns and a perfect image. It's a bit it's really back to nature. You know, from dust we arise and back to dust we fall. So I don't think he cared very much really about what happened to him after his life was over. But he did care very much, I think, that the men and women of the Forest Service take the credit for what happened. So yeah, I haven't seen the words that are part of the burial plot or the deed. described as to how he was to be left in perpetuity, or how the site was to be left in perpetuity. That description has come to me sort of through hearsay, but I don't know where that's written. It would be interesting to find the document, but it would be part of his thinking not to make a big deal of his surrounds in death.
We see when we pick up the book that it says Volume 1.
Yes.
Does that mean more is on the way?
At some point, yes. I would like to be able to produce a Volume 2. In fact, Volume 2 is about 3/4 of the way done. I just have to sit down and focus on the essays and the organization. I've got most of it lined up, though, yes.
And one more story. Tell us about the Baked Apple Club.
Well, the Baked Apple Club is sort of a happy moment in this story. Well, there's many happy moments. This is one that is really film-worthy or movie-worthy, because on Thursday nights, Gifford would assemble or invite these young men and women to his home in Washington on Rhode Island Avenue. There's a big hotel on that site now. I think it's called the Beacon Hotel. And along with the young men and women, baked apples would be sort of assembled by either the cook or Mrs. Pinchot or the mother, I'm not really sure, and cream were fed to the young men and women. And then special scientists and ornithologists and geologists would appear and give lectures to the first foresters or the old-timers who were then young. And they would feast, in a way. Oftentimes they were poor and they had no food, so this represented a meal for them. And they would listen to these lectures and learn about the latest in science and technology of the time. So it was a kind of wonderful experience for them. And the Baked Apple Club, I think, kept meeting for quite a number of years on Rhode Island Avenue. And sort of a sweet moment in the history.
Baked apples. Could there be anything more American and of the land than apples?
And innocent. You know, I think getting back to the origins of who we are as a people, there was an innocence in so much of this work, you know. There was also a kind of novelty to it, an excitement about learning about trees and plants and birds and mammals and, you know, arthropods. And they would learn about these things, and then they would be sent off on horseback, which they would have to, you know, buy their own horses and plod through the fields to get to their posts. But they were sustained by the memories of these Thursday nights at the Baked Apple Club in D.C. Thanks to the Pinchots. Really, this was a family. I mean, this wasn't sustained by the government. This was not paid for by the government. This was sustained by the gift of Gifford Pinchot and his father and mother. So this was a private effort. So I think it's important to remember that. There have been very generous people that showed up in history from time to time, and I think he gave everything he had to these young people so that they could be sustained going forward, and they represented the very first class in the Forest Service.
Is that why you enjoy telling this story, sort of like a Johnny Appleseed that you might be?
Well, yes. I mean, I think it's important to remember that politics was once a very generous sport. You know, we kind of people gave of themselves. They didn't think of what they could get from the story or from their involvement. And I'm not being cynical when I say that. I'm just being completely honest. The more you give, the more you receive. And that's St. Francis at his best. But I do believe that the Pinchots, these early Pinchots, really, really lived this notion. Amos and Gifford and Rosamond and all of them cared very, very deeply for their fellow countrymen and lived by that. The more you give, the more that you receive. So I don't know if I live that way. I just try to get from place to place.
Nobody knows what it takes to put together a book, to write a book, to do the research, to make sure the facts are straight. Not only that, at the same time, you're a practicing landscape architect who's won awards for your vision and your ability. So the apple hasn't fallen very far from the tree, even if you didn't know about Gifford and so forth when you were growing up.
Thank you for saying that. That's so kind. I mean, I knew from having studied landscape architecture about Frederick Law Olmsted, and, you know, about the people that did inspire us from other than the Pinchots. I mean, there have been so many. But when it comes to land, you know, the Pinchots are probably on top. Theodore Roosevelt, of course. John Muir, you know, the Burroughs, and there's so many. But I do think, you know, there's a tradition, and young people need inspiration. So these people in this book of the old timers, hopefully they will inspire young people. I mean, that's what I think Gifford had hoped for.
Bibi Gaston, award-winning landscape architect, author of The Loveliest Woman in America, and most recently, Gifford Pinchot and the Old Timers, exploring the beginnings of the U.S. Forest Service. Bibi Gaston is the great-grandniece of Gifford Pinchot, and she will be in Honesdale tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for an author talk and book signing at the Cooperage, 1030 Main Street, and it's hosted by the Friends of the Wayne County Public Library. There will be a suggested donation at the door. No reservations are required. All proceeds from the event support the library. For more information, on the web, waynelibraries.org, waynelibraries.org. That's Bibi Gaston, the great-grandniece of Gifford Pinchot, and she will talk about her new book, Gifford Pinchot and the Old Timers, in a talk and book signing tomorrow afternoon at 2 at the Cooperage, 1030 Main Street in Honesdale, and it's hosted by the Friends of the Wayne County Public Library. For more information, on the web, waynelibraries.org. Light refreshments and beverages will be served as well. waynelibraries.org.